session number 12368, real one.
Mr. Clark, real one. Can you tell me, first of all, how you came to be a correspondent?
In 1941, Churchill asked that younger war correspondents should be sent into the field. Up to that time, the old World One practice of having writers who went to only to the headquarters and were taken up on occasional sorties to the front when it was quiet had been the case. So that I and about half a dozen others were chosen and sent out towards the end of 1941. In my case, I was assigned from London to join a force that was to be sent towards the Caucasus in case the Red Army, who was in the Nazis, were threatening the Red Army and were half expected to get into the oil fields down there. So I was to join a force that would be sent into Persia to try and stem this and give aid to the Red Army. As it turned out, by the time I got to Cairo, the threat had disappeared, and I was assigned to join the 8th Army, which I did 2 days after I had arrived in Cairo on the Christmas Eve, 1941. 4 days later, I was in the front line at Ajadabia, which is south of Benghazi, where the Rommel had retired after the Crusader battles of the November. There was a fair amount of skirmishing there, and we joined a fight between a County of London Yeomanry regiments who were equipped with honey tanks. The honey tank was so called by an American military advisor in Cairo because for obvious reasons, he thought they were real honeys, and they were in fact very light tanks, but nevertheless the County of London Yeomanry gave a good account of themselves in pursuing Rommel, who retired between marshes just beyond Ajadabia. There was little or no action then for about 3 weeks, but towards the end of January, Rommel came out on his so-called reconnaissance in force and threatened Benghazi. In fact, Benghazi fell without a fight. And I and another war correspondent had to make our way out of the encirclement by going right across the Africa Corps main drive. We escaped all by going very deep into the desert and coming round back into Tobruk.
Who was the other correspondent?
Jan Yindrik, who was an agency correspondent. By the time we got back to Benghazi, a line was being formed at Gazala.
How frightening was it for you to be at the front line for the first time?
I don't know. I'm rather slow in my reactions, thank God. And I don't think throughout the war I ever really experienced more than a couple of occasions real fear. In our escape from Benghazi, we were fired at by the German artillery, and we could see them. But I think it was simply, as a reporter, you look at these things objectively.
Was there a true sensation for you of being surrounded, or did you just know that you were surrounded from being told?
No, we didn't know we were surrounded, but we knew that Benghazi was going to be to fall because we had no substantial forces there at all. In fact, the unit with which I came out of Benghazi was the 4th Indian Brigade under a Brigadier Briggs, I remember. Great soldier.
You were telling me earlier off the record about how you got arrested at Christmas time. Was that Christmas time 41?
41, yes.
Could you repeat that on the tape as an illustration of certain attitudes yes. in the Indian Army at that time?
I arrived in Cairo, as I said, on Christmas Eve 1941. And that night, in the foyer of my hotel, I and a young intelligence lieutenant on leave from Alexandria were approached by six New Zealand soldiers, all of whom had just come out of the very bitter Sidi Rezegh battles. They produced bottles of beer from their battle dress tunics and offered us a drink. Which we took. While we were drinking, the area commander, a Brigadier John Crystal of the Indian Army, came in, and we were, and I and the intelligence lieutenant were arrested and confined to our rooms. Our crime was apparently that we were consorting with New Zealand soldiers who were off in a hotel which was off limits to them, and that we had been drinking with them. The next day, the next day, which of course was Christmas Day, we were ordered to report to the Provost Marshal, who was dressed in riding breeches and was preparing to go off to play a game of polo. Anyway, he was very affable when we went into his office. He sat us down and produced a bottle of whiskey. While we were chatting away, the phone rang and the area commander was on the phone, presumably asking what action should be taken over the two of us. Anyway, as a result, we were taken out to the area commander's headquarters 40 miles out in the desert, where we were both marched in, caps off, stood to attention in front of him, and were dressed down. I remember very well the words which the air commander chose to address us with. He spoke of the heinousness of our crime and the gulf there was and always would be. This little
incident... Between the officers and other ranks.
Other ranks, yes, between the officers and other ranks. This little incident simply gave me a very early impression that the war in the desert was being waged by the Indian Army and in Indian Army fashion, quite unrelated to the blitz tactics of the of Rommel and the Germans. Explains a good deal of why we were continually being pushed back by Rommel whenever there was the fighting flared up in the desert. The conception at one point of building the army's strength around so-called boxes and making sorties out of this was exactly what had happened on the northwest frontier. A good many of the senior officers too were Indian Army.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you having reached the Gazala line, I think you said.
Yes.
Can you pick it up from there?
Yes, indeed. There was a long period of inaction between the January and the end of May, when apart from the odd armoured column sortie towards the Jebel Akhdar, the hilly area in which the Rommel and his force were camped, nothing happened for days and days. But at the end of May, it was quite clear that either Rommel attacked or we attacked. We had built up our forces to such an extent and had a great ammunition dump and supply dump already established in Tobruk, which was in fact intended to take us all the way to Tripoli. However, it was Rommel who attacked first. He did so by coming round the flank at Bir Hakeim, surprising us. I've never been able to understand why it surprised us, because the evening before, I was with the 1st South African Division on the northern flank of the Gazala line. We had seen through our binoculars the German columns, the dust of the German columns approaching us, and we ourselves were subjected to 7 hours of Stuka dive bombing. They would come at us every 20 minutes or so, 5 or 7 of them, and dive down in our position. It proved to me, though, the ineffectiveness of the Stuka attack. They've been devastating in the German attack into France at the beginning of the war, where there were in fact no opposition either in the air or on the ground. But we were quite capable of taking them on with the Yak-Yak guns. In fact, I saw, 13 Stukas destroyed, diving into the ground after their tails had been shot off, and crashing into the ground. In that time, the only damage they inflicted on our division, on the South African division, was one lorry destroyed, 5 men injured, and another lorry slightly damaged. It was completely ineffective. In the days that followed, of course, there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between the two forces. And they became very grueling indeed in what became known as the Cauldron Battle, around a place, one of our defended positions at Knightsbridge. This was a really ding-dong affair. Heavy damage was affected, it was inflicted on both forces, and it wasn't until the Free French the Free French gave up Bir Hakim. I don't want to get. I have a theory about that, but.
Yes, we can come back to that.
Bir Hakim, that Rommel got the advantage. On the January the on June the 13th, our forces were sent against the German positions in what I can only describe as an Indian lancers charge, with their pennants flying, and they went straight into a horseshoe position of Rommel's, of anti-tank guns and tanks. As a result, we lost 260 tanks in one afternoon. Subsequent to that, myself and two other war correspondents started to withdraw to Tobruk, and we, in fact, in our utility car, skirted one of the tank battles without being hit. On the Sunday, Auchinleck, who had come up to the desert to consult with General Ritchie, was at Gambut, the Army Advanced Headquarters, and we had gone back there to deliver our dispatches to the dispatch rider post, which would take it on to the communication flight to Cairo. While we were there, Auchinleck asked to see us. Now, Auchinleck was a taciturn man, usually not given to speaking to the press, but for some reason or other, he asked to see us. We asked him about the outcome of the battle. He didn't mince any words about it. He said that our armoured force had received such a mauling that there was no option for him but to withdraw. The question then arose, what would happen in Tobruk? Would it be besieged again, as it had been in the previous offensive? He explained to us that he didn't expect Rommel to make the same mistake that he made on the first occasion of splitting his force and sending one half to attack Tobruk, which of course withheld for a long siege, and the other half to pursue us to the frontier, to the Egyptian frontier. Auchinleck said he expected Rommel would come on with his entire force, take Tobruk, which he didn't expect to survive if that was the case. And then to come on and pursue us into Egypt. In that case, he said, we said, well, we will stand on the frontier, perhaps, and try after reinforcements to relieve the siege of Tobruk again. He said, no. He said, we will retire all the way to Alamein. Now, Alamein was a place we had never heard of, but when he elaborated on it, we remembered that it was in fact a position with one or two concrete emplacements some 60 miles from Alexandria. It was, as I say, unknown to us at the time, and he asked an ADC to bring his map case, and laying it on the ground, Auchinleck, with his stick, showed the withdrawal through Saloum, Bardia, Fuka, Darba, Mersa Matruh, to Alexandria, to Alamein, only 60 miles from Alexandria. He said that in that case we would hold him at Alamein, and there'd be no reason why we shouldn't do so. It made a lot of sense to us at the time, because all the desert fighting had taken place, as it were, in midfield, with the both sides taking a great deal of damage to their supply vehicles. It was a hard, rocky surface, which was just too much for armor or supply vehicles to withstand for any length of time. And in the end, neither side got a conclusion. But as Auchinleck explained, what he proposed to do was to bring Rommel onto an anvil of his own choosing at Alamein. Thereby, Rommel's line of communication would be so extended, while ours, with all the equipment in the Nile workshops, would be able to reinforce our line at twice and three times Rommel's build-up. And so it happened, as we all know. At Alamein, when the battle broke out, we had three times the superiority in tanks, men, and aircraft.
What was a utility vehicle?
It was just like the present day. What do you call them? Saloon, no, well, just say, yes, shooting break. That's a much better description, yes.
You were going to say why you thought the Free French gave in at Bihaki?
Yes, the Free French and General Koenig had to withstand quite a battering from the Germans, but no more than any other part of the line. But they complained. They were, in fact, not a very French force. They were full of Pacific Islanders, Senegalese soldiers, and Algerians, and so on. And in the end, Koenig refused the supplies that we were taking into him, and asked that they should be withdrawn. And Ritchie, the 8th Army commander at the time, had no other option but to allow them to do so.
Did you visit the Free French?
Yes, I did, yes.
How often?
Only once.
What impression of them did you get?
Well, I didn't see all that much of them, but at the time I went there, they were able to cope quite well.
Was that when the German attack was going on?
Yes, the beginning of the attack. God, I don't know how furious the battle may have got later on, or how impossible it was for Koenig to stand there. When, in fact, they came out, I went out to meet them, at night it was, they were brought out in British lorries, taken deeper into the south, into the desert, given coffee and cigarettes in the moonlight, and brought back all the way to Gambut. It's a little passage of history that's not been properly, for obvious reasons, elaborated.
When you were with Auchinleck, what kind of impression did his presence make on you as a man?
A very commanding person he was. I liked him very much. I in fact, think he was the real architect of the Desert Victory and not Montgomery. Of course, there's controversy about that, but I think Montgomery has made exaggerated claims for himself. The defence of at Alamein, there were, of course, two battles of Alamein. The first one was fought on Auchinleck's plan of digging in the tanks on the Rowaiset Ridge and inviting Rommel to come on. And our arm had then set upon the Africa Corps flank, and they were forced to withdraw. So by the time Monty came out, the situation had been completely stabilised.
Just going back to the narrative, what happened to you personally after your meeting with Auchinleck?
Well, we stayed in the field. We started coming back. There wasn't all that much fighting. We had, of course, to think of our communications, and I think we withdrew to Mesa Matru. There were quite a few stories then to be picked up. I remember one of a lieutenant who had escaped all the way from Tobruk after Tobruk surrendered. He had come out and was pretty... His shoes had given in and his feet were threadbare. And they'd had great difficulties in maintaining themselves for something like a month, keeping out of sight of the Germans. There were stories of that sort. But by that time, the 8th Army was coming back rather bedraggled in small forces. At Mercer Matru, the New Zealanders formed a defensive line and fought very, very well indeed to give other units the time to withdraw behind the Alamein line.
How much cooperation did you get in North Africa from the authorities in doing your own particular job?
I would say it was complete. There was, of course, a limit to the number of correspondents who could be maintained in the desert.